Hello, everybody, and welcome back to yet another Science Studio program. This is Keith Pannell in the studio, and today we're going to be on the telephone having a conversation with a Professor Scott Ness. He's at the University of New Mexico, just up the road. And I say that just up the road because in American mileage and times, it is just about 3.5 hours away. He is the Victor and Ruby Hansen Surface Endowed Professor in Cancer Genomics at the University of New Mexico. So Scott is an expert on cancer and on the science behind what I could call as personalized medicine. And so we're going to be talking about that a little bit. And in the studio also today is Russell Chiarinelli. And so, Scott, welcome to Science Studio.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Before we get into what I like to call personalized medicine and the science that you guys do behind it and gives us the opportunity to look forward, hopefully, let's learn a little bit more about Scott. How did you grow up? Why are you a scientist?
That's a really good question. I came from California, but I moved around quite a bit, but I ended up back in California when I went to college in San Diego and then got my PhD at UCLA. And I've always been fascinated by science, and actually I kind of had planned to go to medical school, but when I was in college, they told us if we're going to do medical school that we should go volunteer at the hospital, and so I did that, and I really hated it. I didn't like being around all the sick people.
Well, that's true. I tell the students that pre-meds, I say, well, it's fine. Why do you want to do this? I say, well, we want to help people. And then I sort of suggest to them, well, perhaps join the Salvation Army. Get out there on a Saturday night and a Sunday morning. They do an awful lot to help people. And I'm being facetious, but not everybody likes hospitals.
Right. You know, and I like the science behind the medicine, so I went into science instead. And I really love doing science and learning about how the body works and how cells work. And that's...
Well, so you've jumped straight from being 0 years old to 20. What was there something around 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 or 15 that sort of tweaked you into science?
Well, my father was a professor of health education. And I think, you know, when I was a kid, we were watching the space program, and I wanted to be an astronaut like everybody else, but then that didn't work out. By the time I was that age, they weren't doing space things anymore. It wasn't really possible.
You were interested in space when you were younger, and I've been reading recently that they're trying to figure out what happens in weightlessness to various diseases and problems that this astronauts have. In some cases it's positive, and in other cases it's negative. Do you know anything about that?
Well, I know not probably much more than you do, although in my field, in the cancer field, we're very concerned about damage to the genome. And one of the big problems, for example, now they're working on trying to send a man or people to Mars.
Right.
And one of the big issues with going to Mars is it's such a long space trip that there'll be a lot of damage to the genomes of the astronauts from the radiation from the sun. And how to build a spacecraft that has sufficient shielding.
Well, that's interesting, Scott. So, I mean, the people that have been up there, I think, what's the longest someone's been in space? About a year?
About a year, yeah.
And is there a clear understanding that they've had some damage?
Well, they have. So they shield the spacecraft, the space station, to prevent radiation from hurting the astronauts. But the shielding is very heavy. So to build something like that is, very difficult. And to build a large spacecraft that could go all the way to Mars and back and also be shielded is a technical challenge.
Yes, that makes common sense. You've got to be a particular breed of person to decide that you're going to go and do that sort of an experiment.
Yeah.
So you got into the genome. So why don't you tell us a little bit about, what it is that your real focus in science is? Obviously, it's the genome and then the impact of cancer on that genome, or the impact of the genome on cancer. What's the sort of general short story about what it is you're trying to do?
Well, the genome is, everyone has heard of the Human Genome Project, which is quite a misnomer, because there is no one human genome. And when we talk about the human genome, the original human genome sequence was actually a mixture of the DNA from five people, so that there would not be one person who was considered the perfect person.
Well, why is that? I don't quite understand that.
They didn't want to have a genome, you know, one person's genome be the reference for everyone else, because as a kind of a comparison. So they mixed five people together, five people's DNA together, and then made the human reference genome.
So who made the choice of the people? Was there an African-American, an Englishman?
I think so, yeah. I think it was a mixture of different ethnic groups.
Is that true? I mean, I hadn't heard that before. I find that very interesting.
Mm-hmm. So we talk about the human genome. We call that the reference genome, and then we measure everyone else's genome compared to that. So the genome is actually a vastly complicated thing that we still know very little about how it works. So people learn in high school that genes make RNA, and RNA makes proteins, and proteins are what do things in the cell. That's where the enzymes are that are important for metabolism. But actually, genes are very complicated, and the genes that encode proteins are really only 2% of the genome. So 98% of the genome, we really don't understand very much about how it works, but it's very important, and that's where most of the mutations occur, or the variants occur between individuals.
So when we talk about cancer, something actually absorbs onto the genome and causes a change. Is that correct?
So generally, it's something that causes a damage to the DNA. So, you know, X-rays or radiation or chemicals that cause the DNA to be damaged. And then when the DNA gets damaged, the cell has to repair that damage. And when the cell tries to repair it, it makes mistakes. And so those mistakes end up changing the functions or the activities of the genes, and so you get what we call oncogenes, which are genes that have now been turned into something that causes cancer. Onco is like oncology, it means cancer, so a cancer gene. So genes that normally are doing the correct thing in normal cells and regulating cells, telling them when to grow and when not to grow in response to external stimuli, now they get modified, so they're telling the cell to grow all the time. That's what an oncogene does, and that's how you get a tumor, because cells are now growing out of control.
But let's go back a little, because you intrigue me when you say that it's 2% of the genome that we think we understand, and yet, you know, there are people out there these days that send away $120 and some spittle,
yeah,
and then they get back, you know, their genetic tree and their predispositions. Are they just looking at one particular part?
So what those companies are doing is they're measuring variants that occur in the population. So when you look at people, of course, we all have different shapes and different skin colors and different hair colors and eye colors, and those changes, those differences are caused by variants in the genome. So everyone's genome is slightly different, and you inherit genes from your mother and father, and you inherit different versions of the genes. There's about 25,000 genes in the human genome, but in fact, there's many, many variants of those genes. And sometimes the variants are in the protein coding region, and sometimes they're in the regions that control how strongly genes get turned on or off, or when they get turned on or off. But the result is that there are these variants. And so what those companies are doing is measuring about 1 million variants, up to 1 million variants that are scattered throughout the genome, and those variants have been found to be associated with different diseases or with the potential to get a disease, something like that.
And different genealogy.
Or with genealogy, exactly. And they may or may not actually be the cause of a disease, but they're closely linked in the genome, close to a gene that might be affecting that or that's been passed down through evolution in genealogy terms. So you can trace a lot of things with only 1 million variants, but actually the genome is about 3 billion nucleotides. So a million is a very, very small fraction of the total genome, but still it's enough to do a lot of get a lot of information from that.
Well, I know that there's a big story about this now going on in the government when one person claimed to be an American Indian and then the genes showed that was only 2% or something like that.
Right.
You know that story?
Yes, I know that story. And actually, the same thing happened to me. When I grew up, my family, we had this kind of story in our family that we were related to Native Americans. And so I sent my DNA off to get measured, and it turns out we're not related at all to Native Americans.
Did you tell the rest of the family, or were they disappointed?
No, I haven't told them.
Well, tell them to listen to the program, and it's all been revealed now.
Right.
Well, one of the interesting things about this whole area of the genetic substance and the genetic data that's out there, apparently in Iceland is particularly useful to a lot of pharmaceutical companies because for years they've kept very good records of the health of families. It goes back, you know, hundreds of years, and Iceland is a very homogeneous community.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people are using the data that the Icelandic health system, I suppose, has collected, coupled with now the modern DNA to, in fact, learn where some of the diseases might be sort of located, if I can put it that way.
That's right. That's right. Iceland has a very, because they have a very, the whole population came from a relatively small group of immigrants that founded the population. And so they're all kind of related to each other, so you can trace genetic diseases.
Do you have any collaborations with cancer research over there in Iceland?
I don't have any there, no. But there's a similar thing going on that has happened in Utah that you might know about, because the Utah has the LDS Church, and they have a similar system of tracing genealogy. And because of keeping track of the genealogy for religious purposes, there are scientific researchers who use that information to trace genetic diseases. And so there's a lot of research there.
Do you have any interactions?
Not direct interactions, but they've made a lot of information public that we use the public.
You should say there's the Mormons, right?
Right, that's right.
LDS, Latter-day Saints. You're listening to Science Studio. My name's Keith Pannell. I'm here with Russell Chianelli, and we're talking on the telephone to Professor Scott Ness up at UNM, University of New Mexico, and we're just going to take a short break. Welcome back to Science Studio. Keith Pannell, Russ Chianelli, Scott Ness in Albuquerque at the University of New Mexico. He's a professor of internal medicine and molecular medicine. We were talking about the genome and some of the interesting features to it. And yes, indeed, you were saying that what the lay public understands as the genome is just a very, very tiny piece of it. And then I remember we've done a program several years ago where somebody was talking about all this so-called junk DNA. And of course, junk DNA isn't junk, as far as I remember the information that we got, that in fact, that's the part of the DNA that sort of turns on and off some of the genes. Is that a reasonable thing to say, and are we making much progress in that with respect to cancer?
Yes, that's correct. There's about 98% of the genome is what was once called junk DNA. We refer to that as the intergenic regions, the regions between the genes. And those regions they're very important for regulating the other genes, determining which genes are on or off in different cell types or at different times of development or in the life of a cell. And of course, 98% of the genome that's where most of the mutations and variants occur, because it's most of the DNA, too. So it's...
Oh, that's interesting. So you could say that it's damage to that quote-unquote junk DNA that, in fact, makes the genes turn off or on in inappropriate times because of initial damage somewhere else.
That's right. So sometimes there can be... So it's a little bit tricky to characterize it too generally, because the protein coding regions of the genome, which are about 2%, are much more sensitive to mutations. So a mutation there can have a much more dramatic effect. So there are, in the intergenic regions, there's definitely mutations that can occur or variants that affect the genes far away from the, you know, in space and the genome. But the but it's much more difficult to predict so we can predict what happens to a protein with very high accuracy if we know what the mutation is in the protein coding region.
Right.
But mutations that occur elsewhere in the genome, in the 98%, it's much more difficult for us to tell what that's going to do. So that's where a lot of the research is now, to try to understand what that part of the genome does and how variants in that region affect the other genes.
So let's talk a little bit about Scott's research. What is it that you are doing up there in this institute? What is it called exactly? A National Cancer Institute designated cancer center at UNM. What is your research? What are you trying to solve?
Right. My laboratory is in the University of New Mexico Comprehensive Cancer Center. So we are an NCI, that's a National Cancer Institute designated cancer center. The National Cancer Institute is part of the National Institutes of Health, and the NCI has a network of kind of official cancer centers that are funded by the NCI and reviewed every 5 years by the NCI to maintain high-quality standards and to do more than just treat patients. We also do research, and we do outreach to the community. So my role here as a researcher is to try to study the diseases, the types of cancer that especially affect our population in New Mexico. And we have some special populations, including a very high percentage of Hispanic patients and higher than usual percentages of Native American or American Indian patients. So we're especially interested in cancers that affect those groups unusually, where there's a disparity so we can trace, not only to try to fix the disparity, but as a scientist, we're interested if those disparities give us hints about what's going on with these cancers and if they can lead us to new kinds of treatments or therapies for those.
Are there indeed special proclivity for cancers amongst those special populations? I mean, is that too general a question to ask?
No, there are things that we have found. For example, an excellent example is pediatric B-cell leukemia. That's a childhood leukemia. So those are relatively rare. We only get about 10 to 20 children with leukemia in New Mexico per year. But researchers here have formed collaborations across the whole country to study all the pediatric leukemias that occur across the country. And a team in our cancer center led by Dr. Cheryl Willman, who's also our cancer center director, found out that a subset of those children who are very high risk for relapsing from disease, so they have a very poor survival generally, they have a mutation in a gene that regulates a particular kinase, which is a protein that regulates other proteins. And when they identified that group of patients based on their gene expression signatures by studying hundreds of these tumors and analyzing the genomics of them, they found this group of patients that were similar in their genomics. And those patients turned out to have higher risk, so they don't respond as well to therapy. And they also turned out then later, which was unknown to us, to also have a higher percentage of Hispanics and Native Americans in that group.
You mean both?
Both. Yeah.
So it's a combination of Native American and Hispanic.
Well, the Hispanics in New Mexico tend to have a higher percentage of Native American genes, so it could be something like that going on. So what we think is that they've inherited a mutation that makes them more likely to get this very rare form of leukemia. And so, but based on that, we've been able to identify, you know, design diagnostic tests to identify those children so they can get special treatment and hopefully have a better survival.
You mean, is that like prophylactic? You can identify them before they have the disease?
No, the disease is very rare, so most children are not going to get leukemia. But amongst the ones who get leukemia, this is also a rare group, but they have, but those patients do much worse than the average kid who has leukemia, which is still a very small subset of children. So it's not worth really screening the whole population because it's so rare. But amongst kids who get leukemia, then they get this new test to find out if they might be in this high-risk group so they can get special care.
What would be the special care? The point is often in the lay public, and certainly myself, we make such advances. We're so clever in being able to find low concentrations of this, that, and the other. And you're doing this work up there with this Native American and Hispanic community. What are we going to be able to do once we have understood that? Is there gene therapy on the horizon for this type of problem?
Well, this is where gene therapy is not quite there yet, but we are trying to do personalized medicine in the sense that if we can identify, so what happens for example, in leukemia like this is that a mutation occurs in the stem cells, which are the very immature cells in the bone marrow that generate all the other blood cells. And so the mutation causes those cells to remain immature and to grow too fast. So instead of what we say is differentiating into all the other kinds of blood cells, the white blood cells and the red blood cells, those cells remain immature. We call those blast cells. And those blast cells grow too fast and fill up the bone marrow, and that's what the leukemia is. So if we can identify what that mutation is, that we might be able to choose which drugs can be used specifically to help those kids because it's a drug that specifically attacks that mutation. So, for example, we've done that kind of thing here. Every pediatric leukemia patient who comes to our cancer center, we sequence the genomes of the leukemia cells to try to identify what the mutations are that have occurred. And sometimes they have a mutation that can be treated with a specific targeted drug that is for that mutation. It's specifically designed for that kind of mutation.
What does it do? How do you design a drug to remove a mutation?
The most common ones that happen, the mutations occur in genes that encode proteins, which are called tyrosine kinases. A kinase is an enzyme that adds a phosphate group to other proteins, and it's essentially a regulatory thing. It's an enzyme that's regulating the growth and division of the cell by doing this enzymatic function. And enzymes can be inhibited by drugs, by using a drug that fits into the active site of the enzyme. And so there's companies designing specific drugs for these specific enzymes, but they're very highly tailored and they only work for, you know, very specific mutations. So the best example of this is a leukemia called chronic myelogenous leukemia, CML, which affects adults. And that mutation is most often caused by a translocation, which is a break between two chromosomes. And the result of the breaking and fusing of two chromosomes is that it creates a fusion gene, an oncogene, which normally doesn't exist. And that fusion gene is an activated tyrosine kinase called ABL or ABL kinase. And there's a specific drug for inhibiting that kinase. So those patients who used to do very poorly, now they can go 10, 20 years taking this drug because it keeps the leukemia cells from growing, slows them down.
So that really is a success story of science coming in there, understanding the process, and then being able to design a drug that will, in fact, nothing to do with the genome itself, but is treating the result of the genomic mutation.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's,
it's exciting.
And that's where many of the kind of personalized therapies have headed, you know, until now, because those are the easiest kinds of mutations to target biochemically. The much more difficult are ones which don't have an enzyme like that where we can design a drug easily. But a lot of these things do respond to different kinds of what are called kinase inhibitors, which are these kinds of drugs which can be used.
Being in the Southwest, Scott, there's a lot of sunshine. So skin cancers and all that type. Do you guys have a special, a special emphasis on skin cancers?
We do have a group here studying skin cancer, and in particular, skin cancer, it's pretty well understood. So we know that it's caused by UV light, and especially it affects fair-skinned people much more. So it's relatively simple to prevent skin cancer just by covering up from the sun or using sunblockers. Nevertheless, there is a lot of skin cancer among fair-skinned individuals. And what we're mostly interested in here is a potential interaction between things like UV light and things that are also present in the environment, like heavy metals, such as arsenic. In New Mexico, there's relatively high levels of arsenic in some kinds of well water, and there's evidence that there's an interaction between arsenic that's consumed by people in their water supply and the UV light. So we're wondering whether, so there's a group here studying that kind of interaction to see if that can be prevented.
That's the first time I've heard of that, and that's very interesting. We run out of time, Scott, but I got one question which is personal, right? I mean, I grew up in England, and so we didn't see the sun. So I sort of was told by somebody, maybe they were just trying to be nice to me, that since I'd seen so little sun in the first 20 years of my life, I was going to be much less prone to skin cancers because it was a major impact on young people, children, and therefore I was less at risk because I came to the sunshine late in life. Any truth to that you know?
Well, in some ways it's true because, of course, the less sun exposure you get, the less likely you are to develop a melanoma, which is the worst kind of skin cancer because it's all dependent on the total amount of exposure you get over your lifetime. So if you wait until you're old before you start going in the sun.
Okay, but that wasn't quite what I was hoping. It's not that the impact is less as you grow older.
Listen, I have a final question too, and that's about aging. What causes aging? I've been reading some things about certain cells that can be taken out, and I think it's called the serotonin or something like that, which can make you live longer.
Well, I think
Russ is getting to that age when you worry about things like this.
Aging. Aging is caused by damage to your genome. So as you get older, your cells collect mutations in their genome through a variety of natural sources. And as those mutations accumulate, the cells become less and less able to do their normal functions, less able to divide and replace.
We've been talking to Scott Ness. He's the Associate Director for Shared Resources, Professor of Internal Medicine / Molecular Medicine, and the Director of Genomics Shared Resource. We thank you for being here, and I thank Russell for being here today, and Sam Castellano for being there at the other end when we needed him. And thank you for listening, and we'll be back next week with some other riveting program. Take care.